SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, a 3D live video journal, which is interactive with discussion, in association with SNI, Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, in cooperation with the UCLA Neurosurgery Department. Linda Liao is the chairwoman, and its faculty are pleased to bring you the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery 101 Lecture Series on Neurosurgery and Clinical and Basic Neuroscience. This series of lectures are provided free to bring the advances in clinical and basic neuroscience to physicians and to patients everywhere. One out of every five people in the world suffer from a neurologically related disease. This lecture and discussion will be given on the management of adult hydrocephalus by Marvin Bergschneider. Dr. Bergschneider is professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at UCLA David Giffen School of Medicine and director of the UCLA Pituitary and skull-based tumor.
I'd like to talk about adult hydrocephalus, and I want to put this disclaimer that many of the things I'm talking about don't necessarily apply to pediatric neurosurgery, particularly very small children, infants, and all that. So I think that's a different lecture to be given by a pediatric neurosurgeon. This is really an experience with adult neurosurgery. This is an outline. These are the topics I'd like to cover today of pediatric patients graduating to adult neurosurgeons. Talk about the slit ventricle syndrome. Talk about long-standing overt ventricular megaly, normal pressure hydrocephalus, and then a little bit about how shunts actually work. So one way to think about hydrocephalus in terms of a disorder is to look at it as a spectrum where you have conditions of very low compliance and conditions of very high compliance. And very low compliance states tend to have very stiff brains. High pressure versus high compliance, you get lower pressure. And that's where the spectrum comes in of a condition even called low pressure hydrocephalus, which is really a iatrogenic condition that's caused by a shunt that you give them a state of very low pressure. But this is just kind of a framework to be thinking about where your patient may lie in all this. The imaging of hydrocephalus is pretty standardized and straightforward by now. You're obviously looking for large ventricles. The ventricles enlarge a little bit like a balloon. One way to think about it, when you have those long-standing balloons, one part of it blows up first, and then the remainder, the end of it, blows up last. Your temporal horns are what usually blow up first, so that's one thing to look for early hydrocephalus. But typically, you want to look for rounding of the frontal horns. And in general, and I'll get to this later, ventricular megaly out of proportion to atrophy, but that really depends on what you consider an atrophy, because you can have an external hydrocephalus that is mimicking atrophy. You obviously want to look for other signs, particularly perhaps higher pressure hydrocephalus, and on MRI particularly, if you see it on the CAT scan, it's usually pretty severe of periventricular transependymal flow. It's interesting, some of the studies of modeling this actually suggest that this is a rare fraction. This is when the brain is moving, it actually sucks fluid into the brain rather than the ventricles pushing it out. But again, no one really is quite sure what it is. But in these four examples, you can see it goes from none to mild to a patient, perhaps the third one, you might consider has acute hydrocephalus. And this patient here has periventricular T2 changes, but this may be more of a vascular etiology with that may have some overlap with hydrocephalus. So in terms of the first topic, Our pediatric neurosurgery colleagues do an excellent job of taking care of children afflicted with hydrocephalus. But once that child turns 18, they kind of come into the domain of adult neurosurgeons, the non-pediatric variety, because many pediatric hospitals really cannot admit an adult patient into their hospital, and these pediatric neurosurgeons, their focus is pediatric neurosurgery. So when I see a patient with a history of being shunted in childhood, it's very important to get their entire history. It's often very complex with many shunt revisions, but try to ascertain why that patient had hydrocephalus. I have that little cartoon here, don't be a lemming. And what I mean by that is just because the patient comes in with a shunt obstruction, you should not just basically follow the last person and just revise the shunt without getting more history to find out why they have a shunt. Because many of these children have aqueductal stenosis but were shunted. And that's just one example where you have an opportunity perhaps to get rid of the shunt. And these patients are some of the happiest patients who are shunt-free for the rest of their lives. But if you just simply, patient comes in with obstructed shunt, I will revise that shunt, you're not doing that patient a potential favor. I found it helpful to find out what type of valves the patients had, what type of settings they had, what worked for them, particularly in young adulthood or late childhood, to give me an idea of what might work and what I should put in if I'm replacing the valve. And always check for papilledema. I can't overemphasize that. If you see a patient in the emergency room and you think the patient has a shunt malfunction and all that, papilledema is obviously something that is bad, but it's also urgent. It tells you that you must intervene rapidly. So that's an important thing with hydrocephalus. Many of these patients are very complex. They have multi-compartment hydrocephalus. They have surgeons who have done multiple operations on them, and you end up with some Rube Goldberg-type apparatus with multiple shunts. They often have orphaned catheters. You're not even sure which shunt catheter is there, which one's working. In general, I've always tried to simplify. If I can, remove orphan shunts and leave the patient, if they can't get an endoscopic procedure, to leave them with one catheter, one valve. And here's a case of a person with putting shunt into the fourth ventricle from a right frontal approach with holes in the different ventricles to try to unitize this. And this patient had come in with one shunt in the fourth ventricle, another shunt from above, two different valves, and just simplified things. Sometimes you have to fenestrate cysts to make it a one compartment hydrocephalus. And I can't emphasize this enough that an ETV, if it works, is the best thing for most patients because the best shunt is no shunt. So always consider aqueductal stenosis.
Marvin, can I ask a question?
Course.
So what's the negative predictive value of papilledema? So if you don't see papilledema, let's say opto, somebody who knows what they're doing, tells you there's no papilledema, what do you do with that information?
Well, that patient could very well still have a shunt obstruction, still be symptomatic. It just tells you that it's not an urgent intervention required. So I don't think it means anything other than it doesn't mean you send the patient home. It just means
Right.
it's not as urgent.
Okay, thank you.
I have a follow-up question to that. How long does it take to develop papilledema?
That's a good question. I believe it's days. I don't think it's immediate, but and it takes weeks to go away.
Right. Yeah, I've always found papilledema to be a good positive indicator, but hard to know, especially if it's a short time course. Without it, they still have symptoms.
So on the low compliance end of the spectrum, we have something called slip ventricle syndrome. I'm going to keep using the term syndrome because the fact that you have slip ventricles on MRI scan or CT scan does not mean that the patient is symptomatic. Many patients are walking around doing just fine with shunts and sweet ventricles. And it doesn't mean that you have to intervene just because you have a radiographic finding. However, I don't think it's a good state to have your patient with sweet ventricles because whenever you have the ependymema touching the ventricular catheter tip, that shunt is more likely to become obstructed over time. So that's not a state you should try to achieve. You should try to achieve normal size ventricles with your shunt. But for patients who are symptomatic, what's a little bit confusing is you would think that a patient who's symptomatic with this has overdrainage. And the reality is, at least in my experience, is that these patients, the slip ventricles were caused by chronic overdrainage. But the reason they're coming in is that their shunt is now almost completely obstructed. And their ventricles have not dilated because the pressure isn't high enough. And I'm going back to that balloon. If you have that long-fitting balloon, I know if you have children, they can't blow it up. But once you blow it up, then they can blow it up because it's Laplace's law that if the ventricles are small, it takes a lot of pressure to dilate those ventricles. So they can have fairly high pressures with small ventricles, and these patients, their catheters are almost completely obstructed. If they have a little bit of drainage, it's not pushing them over the edge. But if you externalize that shunt, for example, clamp it, within 24 hours, usually the ventricles dilate. So the other thing about it is that patients with slip ventricles often they have that because they have aqueductal stenosis, and there's no patients with communicating hydrocephalus tend to have more normal sized ventricles, and it's those with aqueductal stenosis that the ventricles collapse. So when you see this, it's another indicator that maybe an ETV might save this patient and get rid of the shunt. The patient comes in with slip ventricles. So they come in with waxing, waning headaches. It's been reported that they spontaneously hyperventilate. I've never seen that personally, but that's been reported in the literature. And there's actually reports of patients dying of being underdiagnosed and having some incident that causes the demise. So the fact that you see a shunt in a symptomatic patient and non-expanded ventricles does not mean that the patient's fine and send them home. You have to examine that patient. The other end of the spectrum is patients that you find who are sent to you with apparently asymptomatic hydrocephalus. So they're adults. They often have macrocrania. They have large heads, but they have very large ventricles. And the teaching when I was a resident and young faculty back then was you shouldn't touch these patients because if you put a shunt in them, they have a high complication rate. And what you should do is you should wait until they become symptomatic. After all these years of practice, I think that advice was absolutely wrong. And the reason is that after seeing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hydrocephalus patients, I never found one of these patients asymptomatic of over 60. They all became symptomatic. And what I explain to patients is that you have hydrocephalus, basically you're damaging your brain. And everyone in junior high school in the United States is told that you only use 15% of your brain power. I think it's kind of a universal thing, and I don't know where that comes from. But just think about it. You're just chewing up that 85% reserve. And when you become symptomatic, it's because you no longer have any reserve. And if you believe that construct, when they become symptomatic, it's hard to improve them with a shunt because they no longer have any reserve. So the idea of intervening early is you stop that progression and at least put them on the normal aging progression, not the accelerated hydrocephalus progression, because I would just repeat, no one under 60 is asymptomatic. I've never found a patient that was asymptomatic with this. And the ones who were, they rarely got better after I treated them. So the other thing again is that this is often, almost always due to aqueductal stenosis, and you can just do an ETV. If the If the ETV works, and it does in a high percentage of patients, it's great. But if it doesn't, the other thing to think about is when you do an ETV, you're converting someone from not communicating to communicating hydrocephalus. And then when you put a shunt in, the complication rate, in my experience, is lower. The reason why I was told not to shunt these patients when I was in training was because if you didn't do an ETV and you put a shunt, those long-standing large ventricles, they collapsed. You got subdurals, and these patients did very poorly. But if you do an ETV and if that doesn't work, then you put a shunt in, there's a lower risk of subdural hematoma. So how do you evaluate a patient with if you suspect they may have aqueductal stenosis? So this is the same patient that was sent to me for a shunt and came with that sagittal T1, and I ordered a cyst exam, and you can see the difference between that T1 and that cyst. The cyst shows multiple aqueductal webs and obstructions versus that T1. You might think of oh, that might be open. So, just so you know, cyst is a name of a sequence for a Siemens MRI scanner, and Fiesta is a name sequence for a GE. They're identical sequences. You're wondering why there's two different names. It's because two different companies named them. So I have no idea what the Philips sequence is called, but it's very important to get to me a cyst exam. And there's a couple of reasons. One is that you can see what the aqueductal anatomy is, what the fourth ventricle anatomy is, but you can also see what the prepontine space anatomy is to see whether it's safe, technically safe to do an ETV. Some people are fond of CSF flow studies as a different patient, and I don't have the dynamic study, but I personally don't find these very useful, and they can be misleading because you can get jets of flow next to a web due to turbulence that may not even, there still could be a web. You could be fooled by these studies. So I personally don't find them useful, but I would leave it up to you and with caution. I mainly go by anatomical imaging. So Sasha, you always seem to be the favorite resident to call on because you're so nicely set up here in the front. But we'll just go right. Do you know what A is?
Optic chiasm.
Very good. Good, all right. What's above the optic chiasm? Well, so the pituitary stalk comes from the posterior inferior and goes down. So we're talking about above chiasm. Ashley.
Is that pointing to like infundibular recess?
No, it's a structure. So the infundibular recess would be back here behind it. So this is an actual structure. You open it if you do an ACOM aneurysm clipping sometimes.
Yeah, the membrane. That silicous membrane would be below.
Anybody want to help her?
Long
And the lambda terminalis. Very good.
Yes.
All right. And then what's above the lambda terminalis? What's the superior part of the lambda terminalis?
Anterior culture.
Anterior commissure. Very good. And then what's that? What's these pointing to a space? Peter?
Quadrigeminal cyst.
Well, so right. Well, it's you could call it that, but it's the pineal recess or the suprapineal recess. And then what's E?
Steric.
Is right. So these are important landmarks. And by the way, for CT scans, the CT scans are lined up, or maybe say MRI scans are lined up on the ACPC line in terms of that's how they're scanned. CT scans actually aren't lined up that way. Very good. Okay. Now, more A. This is a view from an ETV when you're in the lateral ventricle. Coming to the right side.
I'm totally blanking.
So what separates the two ventricles? What structure literally separates the two lateral ventricles? That's the septum. Lucid, right? So that's what you're looking at. So what so it will be
The caudate vein?
Well, so this is in the septum pellucidum.
Oh, the septal vein.
Right, this is the anterior septal vein.
Fornix.
Fornix, very good. And then D is big hole called the...
These pictures are right off the written boards, by the way.
Right, so this is all the written boards, yeah. and you may be tested. So I got this from CNS Nexus. Anybody want to venture? Josh, what is E? Actually, that's what it's labeled at in the CNS Nexus, but it's actually wrong because it's interesting that if you look at this image, again, here's your mammillary bodies, here's the supercilium, here's your infundibular recess, your chiasm. Remember, the infundibular recess is below, so your chiasm is actually above and in front. What they were looking at here, I don't know why they labeled it that way. That's just the dorsum cella. That's the top of the clitoris. So they literally got it wrong. So important anatomy to understand. So I showed you the cross-sectional, but you see the same thing on an endoscopic view, and you should know all this relative anatomy. And with a flexible scope, you can actually loop back in the posterior third ventricle and see the aqueduct, you can see the pineal recess, you can see the posterior curvature, the venula, all those structures. So very important anatomy to know. All right, so I'm gonna switch now to NPH. I think every medical student knows the clinical triad, and somewhere there's a book that says that this is wacky and wobbly, apparently. Maybe it's a good way to remember it, but very inaccurate way to actually characterize what it is. It is a triad of gait disturbance, urinary symptoms, and dementia. You know, the history of NPH is interesting. It was really discovered came out or popularized by Hakim, who was a Colombian neurosurgeon who went to the Brigham. And they studied three patients. This is pre-CAT scan imaging. And three, they didn't understand what was wrong with them. They did lumbar punctures, and these three patients happened to have normal pressure. And then when they did pneumoencephalograms, they found they had hydrocephalus. And that's where the name came out. It came from three patients. But as we'll get to a little bit later, it is a bit of a misnomer because it's not necessarily normal pressure, but it's stuck in there. The other interesting thing about this story is that that seminal paper that was written, Hakim wrote it, put himself as first author, but the I think it was maybe the neurologist at the Brigham convinced him that things were supposed to go in alphabetical order and put his name first in the publication, so he put his name first. So it is a disorder of the elderly. So it's not something you typically see in patients younger than 65. The mean age is 74. Most cases are idiopathic, which obviously means we don't know what the cause is, but there is a secondary NPH, post-subarachnoid hemorrhage, post-meningitis, post-TBI. It's increasingly common as you age. A study out of Japan showed a almost 3% prevalence of patients, people over 65. So it is something that is that you'll see in your practice. So the gait, so this is a patient here who I think shows the pretty classic characteristic gait of this magnetic gait. You just have to imagine that his feet have like magnets on them and they're stuck to the floor. He's trying to elevate them. And what happens is that anything that's not automatic he basically, his brain's not working. So these patients, if you tell them, take a right step, left step, you can walk them and they will walk. And then you ask them who's the president while they're walking, all of a sudden they start, because they can override this and go on manual, but their autopilot is off. And this is what they look like. They take these little bitty steps, and when they can't transition from grass to gravel and all that, because their brain, you and I do this automatically, their brain doesn't. You and I, when we're walking down an incline, a steep driveway, we will automatically change our gait, our posture. Their brains can't. The feet get stuck, and they basically go flying forward, and they come in with now other problems. So the urinary symptoms, incontinence is actually a late finding. Most patients have urgency. They know every Chevron station in Los Angeles, whatever, because they know they basically kind of have a spastic bladder, and they have to urinate when they first get the urge. And only very late do you find a patient with only long-standing NPH where they have incontinence and are unaware of that. What popularized this disorder early on was this treatable dementia. It's a subcortical dementia. If we know the difference between the two, it's just caused by white matter changes. And I think the easiest way to remember this is cortical dementias cause a lot of behavioral changes versus this here just causes slowness. I will say that one of the most characteristic features of this is that the patient's there with their family. You ask the patient, do you have short-term memory problems? And the patient's doing this, and every family member's doing this, because the patients are just unaware of their short-term memory problems.
You just don't remember.
They don't, but it's uncanny that they are just unaware. And again, it's something that you usually see later in the disorder of NPH. So patients typically present with gait problems first, then bladder, and then memory. So if you see someone coming in with just memory problems and no gait problems, I usually had a very high suspicion that this was not NPH. NPH is primarily a gait disorder. If you study them with no cognitive test, I mean, they fail on many, many domains beyond memory. So it's important to know that. I mentioned atrophy before, and I actually think this is a very interesting study out of Japan. And I look at this every time. If you look at the coronal imaging, if you see crowding by the superior sagittal sinus medially, very high incidence of NPH. So see, this patient here has big spaces in their cervical fissure. You might say, oh, they have atrophy. But the patients who have atrophy here. You'll see them that they have their brain is a good centimeter away from the fox. That's a patient with atrophy. This is a patient with NPH who, for whatever reason, has external hydrocephalus here and crowding at the top. So really important finding. Always look for this in terms of if you're trying to distinguish who has NPH and who doesn't.
Marvin, some of the board studying and whatnot talks about the vertical angle of the medial ventricles. Is that something you put a lot of stock in or no?
I never had, but there's all sorts of different findings. Aqueductal CSF flow. There's all these things that have been proposed, but I actually found this one the most useful because you see this, what looks like atrophy. And you tell patients that I used to tell them before this that when you just have atrophy.
Right.
This actually is.
No, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah, they just so the residents know, there's like a. Absolutely. I don't remember the degree of angle from the midline that middle part of the ventricle and coronal come at, but there's some sort of angle, and beyond that is highly suggestive of MPH.
Can I enter real quick? Why do you call it external hydrocephalus rather than just cerebral volume loss in the Sylvian fissure?
I think they proposed that was actually added CSF rather than loss of brain. I don't know. I guess my point was, and I guess, Dr. Kim, you're correct. I don't think anyone knows, but if you look at an axial study through that plane, it looks like atrophy. But this patient actually has NPH.
I see. Okay. So they proposed. Okay. Thank you.
So this was a process that I participated in with the late Dr. Marmorow. We went through months of meetings back when they were in person with a large group of hydrocephalus experts trying to come up with guidelines. I will say that it's an interesting process to come up with guidelines. It's actually rare to get consensus. I think the only thing we got consensus on was that we all did dislike the nuclear medicine sonogram, and we all gave that a thumbs down. Other than that, the guidelines that we put out were more or less a consensus, but they by no means were unanimous. But I think it was an important contribution to the literature. The way I look at it, because there are proponents for all sorts of different studies, and all the studies have methodological issues and concerns with them. But there's some people who just do lumbar punctures, other people do high volume lumbar punctures. I would say most NPH centers do external lumbar drainage. And there's some people who just say, oh, I just put a shunt in because that's the test. They get better with a shunt. And you kind of have to kind of understand each one of these tests. If you just do a lumbar puncture or even a high volume lumbar puncture, patients who, if they improve, they're only improved for a couple of hours, maybe a day. I'm going to come back to that, but that's really important because you remember that gate video, and I should have put the other video of, again, if you walk that patient, if you deliberately tell them, okay, get up, I want you to walk and deliberately do that, they actually can do that. And I think part of the problem with these tests was they did a lot more punch, they got up and said, okay, let's go for a walk. And the patients looked better just because they were concentrating, they were motivated. I don't think it was necessarily a placebo effect. I think it was truly a motivation, concentration effect. And the problem with the shunt is, and we'll get to that, is if your shunt's not working properly, if it's not draining enough, you're effectively not doing anything. So you can come up with false negatives with that. So I think that the external lumbar drainage is the gold standard. This was, studied by Dr. Marmorow, and he found a 90% positive predictive rate for a large cohort of patients. The protocol kind of came into development, had coffee, especially they would drain patients for 20 cc's an hour. A lot of patients got subdural hematoma, so they cut it back, and this number kind of just came out of experience of 10 cc's per hour. How many days? Also, kind of came out by some convention of 3 days of drainage, but I do believe it's the gold standard. But what I kind of want to get into is why it's such a good test for NPH. And so the first thing to understand, and this applies to other parts of neurosurgery, when you have a lumbar drain in for 3 days and you pull it out, there is a CSF fistula that continues, and you have drainage of CSF into the paravertebral musculature. And Marmorow studied this, well, by inference, that patients were better for 8 to 10 days after they pulled the drain out. And then they all got worse again. So just think about that. So when we have patients with lumbar drainage because of a CSF leak after a transsphenoidal case, you do 3 days of drainage. I don't like to do the clamp test. I like to pull it out because you get another 8 days of drainage effectively afterwards. Versus if you clamp it, then you might invoke a CSF leak. That's someone who might not be leaking. So, but and I know that based on the NPH data. So, because of this, I don't really rely on what all the testing is done in the hospital. When I get a referral or someone says, "Oh, we did the lumbar drainage test," and the physical therapist got the patient and walk with the patient and said the patient's better. Well, again, that can be a very motivated, they just have this drain in their back. They got those hospital slippers. They got their gown open in the back. Maybe they want to walk faster back to their bed. I don't even, I almost don't pay attention at all to what happened in the hospital. The important thing is you must send that patient home after the drainage test. Do not send that patient to rehab. You just negated your whole test because now you have physical therapy working with the patient. What you want to see is how is that patient back at home in their natural environment with the family? And remember this, nobody has 7 good days in a row. We may have a good day in a row, 1 good day, but nobody has 7 good days in a row. So if the family came back and said, "We're not sure whether he got better, can you tell me?" And I would just say, "You just told me." If the improvement is not enough where the family can appreciate it and think, "Wow, that's a meaningful improvement," don't shunt that patient. Because all these tests of the get up and go, they do it 1 second faster than they did before, is meaningless. It's a good number for a study, but it's meaningless in terms of the quality of life of the patient. If they go home and they're meaningfully better, shunt them. If there's no improvement, the family can't tell. Well, they're not going to be able to tell after a shunt either. So I don't think you did anything good. I mean, you might argue that you may slow their progression, but I don't think the risk-benefit ratio applies for that. So the other thing is equally important is that this is what mothers say to their kids: you get what you get, and you don't get upset when you're trying to feed them food. It's the same thing with a lumbar drainage trial. You get to see how much they improve, and that way the family knows when you've shunted them what to expect in terms. So they're not have these unrealistic expectations of how much they're going to improve. Equally important is when you're now titrating the valve setting, you know when to stop because you know how much they got better after lumbar drainage, and don't keep going beyond that because the subdural hematoma risk starts going up with very little utility of getting more improvement. That makes sense? So it's an excellent test for many different reasons. So here's this patient 6 months after a VP shunt, same one that I showed, and you can see he has a little something to, he's walking around, he's much happier, his transitions are better, he's smiling. I would say the one negative side effect of his shunt, this is a true story, that his wife left him because he was now able to chase her around the house because he became friskier. And he literally told me that she left him because he could now catch her. So I'm going to pivot one more time and now go to the shuntology and talk a little bit about how shunts work and how to perhaps avoid complications.
Maybe you didn't fix the wacky part.
So almost every valve manufactured are differential pressure valves. This is really important to understand. So basically, the valve mechanism, there's a ring, there is a sphere that settles in the ring, and there's a spring on top of the ball. It's a check valve. Fluid flows in this direction. It pushes the ball up by going past the spring pressure. The fluid cannot go in a retrograde fashion because it seats the ball into the ring. Does that make sense? That's what a check valve is. When you're adjusting a valve, you're just adjusting the amount of spring pressure on that valve. That's what you're doing. These one-way valve, I believe, is mandated by the FDA because early shunts were VA shunts, and they did not have valves in them, and basically blood went into the ventricles, and the VA said, the FDA said, you must put a check valve in there, so it only goes one direction. But there's a problem with a check valve, and we'll get to that. But so let's say that you have a valve set at 200. That means it takes 200 millimeters of water pressure to get past this valve. But just so you know, 200 millimeters of water pressure is 20 centimeters of water. You can divide by 1.36 and get millimeters of mercury because ICP numbers in the unit are in millimeters of mercury. But remember, the valve settings are in millimeters of water. They're not the same. In general, higher valve pressure means less CSF flow, but that's not necessarily true. So here's two scenarios. You have a valve set at 200. The pressure on the inlet's 210, and the pressure on the outlet is zero. CSF water will flow until that pressure gets that differential pressure gets below 200. Here's another scenario. Pressure is zero here, and the outlet's minus 210. Same amount of flow. These valves are dumb valves. They don't know what the pressure is. They work on a differential pressure. That's really important to understand. When you set the valve pressure, you are not setting ICP. The valve has no idea. All it knows is the differential pressure across that valve. So, but it just so happens that the inlet pressure for a V ventriculo, whatever shunt, is intracranial pressure. So just remember that. We are, most of our patients, upright beings, and there is therefore a hydrostatic column for EP shunt. And just for the average person, it's about 400 millimeters of water, or 400 millimeters from here to here. So you have a fluid column on the other side, and CSF is going to flow downhill down that. You can literally can siphon CSF out from the brain. So you all know that you can measure pressure. That's what that measurement means, of so many millimeters of water pressure behind to that column. Now, but if you have a straw and you pick up that straw with fluid in it, nothing flows, but the pressure on top of the straw where your finger is the negative of the height of the column. You're stopping that flow. So if that straw is 500 millimeters long, your finger is putting negative 500 millimeters of water pressure to stop that fluid from flowing down there. So when you stand up, you can see this straw develops negative pressures in your head until it stops flowing. So there was a researcher named Portnoy who basically said, well, okay, we can sort of determine or figure out what that pressure is by you have that height column, you have the valve, which is giving you an offset, you have a distal pressure for VP shunt in your abdomen. So just think about it. The higher the valve pressure, the lower the ICP. The shorter the person, the less negative pressure you have. So that's why this is a negative number. The higher the abdominal pressure, the higher the ICP, right? So it kind of just makes sense empirically. So if you have this person at a height of 400 standing up, valve set at 70, just assume that the distal pressure is 100, you would predict that their ICP at valve setting of 70 is minus 230 millimeters of water pressure under standing up. This is what the so-called Portnoy equation would predict. And because of that, and this negative pressure, they came up with all these anti-siphon devices that were very popularized in the 70s because the percentage of patients getting subdural hematomas was very high. They didn't recognize or didn't really appreciate the importance of ETV, and they were putting valve pressures in, very low valve pressures, because they thought you needed a low valve pressure, like for NPH, to shunt a low pressure, you need a low valve pressure. Completely wrong. We'll get to that why. So, take-home message: a valve setting at 140 does not set ICP at 140. Don't think that that's the case. That's just wrong thinking. So we set out to study this with actual data. I always love this slide because you can see Dr. Yang with his BA here. And John Cook was one of our residents here. So what we did was we brought in patients for NPH evaluation. We put a common ICP monitor on in them to measure B waves overnight. Next day, we did a lumbar drain, sent them home without the ICP monitor. They would come back many weeks later for their VP shunt, the ones who responded. At the time of the VP shunt, put a Cobden monitor in them, put a Cobden monitor in their abdomen when we put the VP shunt, so we were measuring actual peritoneal pressure. And then before their lumbar drain and after their shunt, we measured their pressures at flat in bed, 10 degrees, 30 degrees, 45 degrees, measuring their ICPs at all these different settings. And then we did that at the setting of 200, 170, 140, 80, 50, and 30. So we did that every valve sample. Took 2 hours for each patient. But this is what we got. So interestingly, when patients were lying flat, their mean ICP was 164 plus or minus 64. So here's the individual curves for all the patients we studied. And what you'll see that some of them actually did have elevated pressures. Some of them had a pressure of 60 lying flat. So some of them did have normal pressure hydrocephalus, so-called, but many of them didn't. But if you see that all their curves are sort of the same. We stand someone up, we get someone up, their ICP drops, and some of them drop negative. At 45 degrees, their intracranial pressure is negative. Some of them were still positive, but NPH is not NPH. In terms of pressure, there's quite a variety of that and important. But we took a mean of that. So as I mentioned, this is what we did, and we did all these studies on these patients.
Marvin, where's that variability coming from? Is that the abdominal pressure? Is it a
Good
mix of?
question. Yeah, we don't know. Different compliance, different height, different abdominal pressure. It's a lot of factors that we don't understand, but it is what it, that's why you study it and you see that there's a lot of variability. Good question. So one of the assumptions we made was that, the common abdominal pressure was the same as it was preoperatively as it was after you did the shot. Not necessarily true, but we couldn't find a reason to put an abdominal monitor in someone coming in for a lumbar drainage trial. The average abdominal pressure was 69 plus or minus 23. If you elevate the head a bit, there was a increase in abdominal pressure, and there was a mild correlation with BMI with the abdominal pressure. Not strong correlation, but there was some correlation. So here's what we found. And so what you see here are individual curves. The darker curve on top is the average curve of all the patients before the shunt, and then the average curves after the shunt at 200, at 170, at 140, et cetera, all the way down to 30. That makes sense? So this is kind of what happened actually after when we put a shunt in. So back to the Portnoy equation. So what did the Portnoy equation predict? Well, it kind of predicted that, let's say that you have a patient who is lying at 10 degrees, a valve set at 70, the valve set at 200, that it predicted that the ICP would be higher than the actual ICP was that it was pre-op. So what that means is that that shunt won't flow. You're lying flat. The Portnoy equation suggested that, well, you don't have any flow. And then it also suggested when you raise the patient up that you get these dramatic negative pressures, that you get siphoning, and more people would get apparently subdural. So this is what it predicted. So again, here's the average pre-shunt. So for all these shunt pressure values above head of bed elevation, it predicted that there would be no difference, there would be no drainage, and then it predicted over-drainage. But the reality is that's not what we found. That's why you do science and why you do experiments, is that even at 200, the average valve ICP was lower. So if you just look at this, you did not get the extreme amount of siphoning that the Portnoy equation predicted, and patients were being drained even when they were laying flat, even at 200. So, just like I said, you really didn't get that degree of negative pressures. And interestingly, the shape of the curve was pretty. So, when you program a valve, you're just kind of lowering the patient like this, kind of linearly, if you get that more negative pressures. So, you may ask, well, at a valve setting at 200, preoperatively, the mean pressure was 164. How can it be that the mean pressure after the shunt at setting at 200 was 125. It was statistically lower than it was. You say, how was that possible? So I think the reason is that ICP is pulsatile. You all know that. You see in the waveform on the monitor. And that, remember, differential pressure valves are one-way valves.
Sorry.
surgery.
It's required by the FDA, but this is what's causing the issue. They respond to instantaneous pressures. So let's take, this is real patient data where we actually have their peritoneal pressures and all that. So this is the ICP waveforms monitored. So this is, you know, each one, it's compressed. But what you can see here, this patient here had a mean preoperative ICP of 175. The valve was set at 200. We know what his peritoneal pressure was. And what you can see here is Portnoy basically predicted that this is the point that both the ICP are
up. Well, isn't there someone technically here all the time? It's just not the decision maker. Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
So these peaks are above that line. That makes sense?
Yes.
So on the average, it should flow. But also, so every time the ICP peaked above that point, CSF went out, but it can't go back in because of that one-way valve. So it's like a little pump. Every time it just keeps on pumping a little aliquot of CSF out to lower your ICP. And you can see the mean ICP was 155 after a shunt, same settings. But if you take this patient here, whose mean ICP was 135, you look at Portnoy's equation, the peritoneal pressure was higher and all that, way up here, identical postoperative. Well, this patient did not drop their ICP at 200. This would be a non-responder at 200, versus the other patient could very well respond at 200. So you cannot look at mean pressures necessarily and understand that ICP is pulsatile. Now, this is probably how shunts are working and why they overdrain. Not necessarily so much because of siphoning, but because of this phenomenon. It's basically you set the valve pressure too low. So our protocol was always set at 200 and start programming the patient down over time, because the reality is that we don't measure continuous ICP preoperatively, so we don't know what it is. So I showed you NPH data. Yes, so.
Just a quick question. So did you get a sense, I've always been like confused by this, that whether they're, because I mean, when they're upright, there's the siphoning, some amount of siphoning effect or like negative pressure, depending on their peritoneal pressure. So they're tend to drain more technically when they're upright. But then again, when they're flat, you have higher ICPs, so that you would think that they would drain more then as well. Like, did you get a sense of which of those was where they were doing the majority of their drainage?
I don't think we've ever measured it. So it's a good question.
Just thinking, like, if you want to limit someone's drain, like, let's say, like, a subdural, NPH subdural comes in, and they have, like, a Hakim or something that you can't turn off. Like, if you wanted to limit their drainage while you were sorting out, like, a takedown to tie it off or something, would you have them sit up or lay flat to, you know?
Again, with those curves, you see, they're pretty linear. So if you increase the valve pressure, you will increase the ICP, both flat and upright. So it happens in both. But I'm not sure what all the different forces are, because the Portnoy equation should apply. There's something else going on here that it doesn't apply.
Were you able to sort of plot in the data a modified equation with like a new term for the dynamic oscillations on top of just the column of water that was more accurate to
it? Should have. Good question. Just remember that NPH, those values are lower than you're going to find in young adults. Young adults have ICP spikes up to 400, up to, I mean, they're much higher. So, and that's why I put in the previous slide that NPH is the presentation of hydrocephalus in older adulthood, because they don't get the headaches. The younger adult comes in with headaches, nausea, but if you were to not treat them, they would become ataxic. They would become incontinent. They would have memory problems, but they get way too sick before that because they have very high intracranial pressure. It's a different presentation because they don't have the headache symptomatology. But if you think that you want to have a 30-year-old adult with hydrocephalus and you put a valve setting of 70, you're going to way overdrain that patient because their ICP spikes are probably 300, 350, 400. They're always going to be flowing. You go back over drain that patient, and that was the patient she gets the metric. And so important thing to know. So younger patients, basically, I treat with valve settings of like 300. And this concept of the Certas valve of 400 being off may be true for an 80-year-old, not true for a 30-year-old. It's probably still working. It's probably not draining a lot, but it is not off. So don't set valves at low pressures because you're trying to achieve a normal pressure. You just don't understand how shunts work. This is General Monterey. He was the one that was brought in to Katrina after the disaster response. And this was his saying, telling the soldiers to put their guns down. Very interesting man. I should read the book. So I'll talk briefly about overdrainage then. It's a syndrome. You know, one of the findings of if you work up a patient with intracranial hypotension, you look for pachymeningeal enhancement. It turns out for a shunt, it's an indicator that your shunt's working because patients with shunts have intracranial hypotension. So if by a finding is not indicative, you get a syndrome because you have symptoms associated with that. So if you look at the lumbar puncture literature, 10% of people who get lumbar punctures get spinal headaches. I think the reality is that everybody has intracranial hypotension after a lumbar puncture. 10% of people are symptomatic with this. So that's the difference between that. Basically, the same thing probably goes with shunts. 10% of your patients are going to have low pressure headaches. And those are the patients that you have to add some other device to counteract that. So you can have subdural hygromas, hematomas. You know, that's obviously something that you have to intervene for. And children, what they do is you get very small heads because they're chronically overshunted, and then you may end up with slit ventricle syndromes and things like that. So, you know, the Dutch did a very interesting study for NPH. Again, back in a time where they thought that you had to put a low-pressure valve to drain low pressure and normalize pressure. So they randomized people to get a valve setting. It's 50 or it's 90. 70% of the people who got a valve setting of 50 got subdural hygromas. 30% at 90. And at 300, we looked at our data, we had 3%. So if you look at that, you can just plot where you want to be on this curve. If you want all your patients to get subdural hygromas, set your valve setting low initially. But if you don't, you start here and then you work your way back. That's the bottom line here. We, as neurosurgeons, have been chronically overdraining people. Pediatric neurosurgeons are also guilty of this, and why we have so much overdrain is because they overdrain the patients thinking that you need a low valve setting. Well, quickly, so this is the valve. I think this is the most used valve in the United States right now, like the common Certas valve. And I just want to emphasize again that 8 is not necessarily off. I think it's a good design, but don't, you know, it is virtual off. I think, a bit of a overstatement. If you have a patient with overdrainage, one way you can address that is with this M-Blue valve. But this is a gravitational valve that basically has these little tantalum spheres that when the patient stands up, these spheres drop and redirect CSF to basically another differential pressure valve. So when they're laying flat, they have zero added pressure. So you have a normal valve, you have a Certas valve, you put this valve, whatever the Certas valve, say the Certas valve is set at 100, you have 100. When they get up, if this valve is set at 400, your Certas valve is set at 100, you effectively get 500 when they stand up. Unfortunately, this valve comes in settings of 40, 30. It's the centimeters versus millimeters issue, so don't get confused with that. It's very critical that this valve must be positioned so it's vertical when the patient's standing. Yeah. If you have it off, you get all sorts of wild results. So I just said that. So If I have a very tall patient, I will generally put one of these valves in because they have a much higher incidence of low pressure symptomatology. The siphon guard is another way of addressing this. I don't have much experience with this. Dr. Kim has more experience with this. I think it does work. If you look at the numbers that is how this valve flows, and the numbers that the manufacturer states, you look at actual CSF flow rates through shunts and particularly normal pressure hydrocephalus, those numbers don't match up. But I think the fact is that this probably does work for some patients. So it's another one in your armamentarium. So, any questions?
What valve do you use first line for NPH now?
I just put a Certas valve, seven.
Not an anti-siphon, just a Certas.
Unless the patient's very tall,
Yeah.
or if they complain of over-drainage headaches with a lumbar
Way
drainage
down,
trial,
right? Yeah.
I will put in an AMPLIO valve.
Marvin, that was a really, really great presentation. And obviously, I learned everything about hydrocephalus from you. I think the Jeremiah, to your point, I kind of switched over to the siphon guard once just to see, you know. We have a paper coming out actually that demonstrates that returns to ER for subdural hematomas and falls related to overdrainage were lower since we started implementing that. So it has been an interesting clinical outcome study, the Certas versus the Certas siphon guard. How much of that's really directionally correlated? There's a lot of bias because it's later on in our series, but it is something that we have noticed. And then my second point, as far as doing the MPH patients for the residents, Dr. Bergsteiner mentioned how this aqueductal stenosis and ventriculomegaly in younger patients become symptomatic. You'll see a lot of secondary MPH, which is when there's an obstruction or hydrocephalus that presents like with the three W's. And those patients, you should always, always, always be suspicious of aqueductal stenosis. So if I see a referral for MPH for patients that are in their 60s or less, I'll always get a sagittal cyst protocol to rule out aqueductal stenosis because I think I get about a 50% hit for these quote unquote MPH patients that actually just have an aqueductal web.
The next slide contains the key references for them from this talk. Take a screenshot of it for your records. Other references are noted in this publication. We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The views and opinions expressed in this program are those of the author or interviewee and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of SNI Digital or its management. The information contained in this article should not be considered to be medical advice. Patients should consult their own physicians for advice as to their specific medical needs. Please fill out your evaluation of this video. And at the bottom of the home page on the major video, you'll see a rating scale and choose the stars 1 to 5 to help us improve the information we bring to you on SNI Digital. Foundations supporting these programs believe there are many ways to learn. SNI Surgical Neurology International is a 2D internet journal with Nancy Epstein as its editor-in-chief. Its web address is sni.global. SNI Digital Innovations and Learning is a 3D video journal which is interactive with discussion, and its web address is snidigital.org, and both are free 24/7, 365 on the internet. SNI Surgical Neurology International is read in 239 countries and territories. It has the third largest readership of neurosurgery journals. And SNI Digital Innovations and Learning is viewed in 148 countries in the last 12 months since its publication. It's the first video journal on the first video journal of neurosurgery. Foundation believes in helping people throughout the world. This recorded session is available on snidigital.org. Click the icon at the bottom of the right of the homepage for any questions, comments, or requests for CME credit. SNI is now offering this program and others on podcasts on Apple, Amazon, and Spotify under SNI Digital. Foundation also supports the Medical News Network, bringing truthful medical and science news to the world. It's copyrighted by James I. and Carolyn R. Ausman Educational Foundation. All rights are reserved. Contact Dr. Ausman at the email address listed. Thank you. We hope you enjoyed the program.